Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present independent journalist Joanne Wipajewski, who examines the privilege and entitlement Brett Kavanaugh learned at his elite prep school that carried over into his partisan political activism and legal career. Dee Parvez, global politics reporter with Think Progress, who assesses world reaction to President Trump's presence at this year's UN General Assembly, which provoked both anger and laughter. And Carolyn Lush, program manager with Bike New Haven, who explains how her city's public-private partnership-operated bike share program differs from other similar programs across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Nearly 400,000 people have died in South Sudan's five-year bloody civil war, according to a study by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, funded by the U.S. State Department. The level of carnage and death from disease is much higher than previous UN estimates. Although a power-sharing agreement was signed in September, Western observers fear the peace deal is in danger of falling apart at any time. The new study shows the level of carnage in South Sudan, the world's newest nation, rivals the death toll in the Syrian civil war. Over 4 million people in South Sudan were forced to flee their homes, and 1 million refugees have fled into neighboring Uganda. Moreover, 7 million people rely on humanitarian aid for their survival. Today, there are over 14,000 UN peacekeepers in the embattled nation at a cost of over $1 billion a year. A peace deal was signed in 2015, but collapsed in July 2016, forcing rebel leader Machar to flee to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The resumption of the war was followed by the bloodiest fighting of the conflict and repeated atrocities against civilians. In the nation of Jordan, psychologist Ala Farouk is now a self-proclaimed Muslim Democrat. He's dropped his former allegiance with the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood and now embraces women's and democratic rights. Farouk insists the era of political Islam is dead. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the psychologist is part of a growing movement of Islamic activists from Tunisia, the epicenter of the Arab Spring that spread to Jordan and Malaysia, embracing a new era of moderate politics. These activists express support for ethnic and religious minorities, as well as secular Muslims. Leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood are also advocating moderation and engagement in multi-party politics. This is seen as a dramatic change from the early 1990s, when the Brotherhood called for Sharia law and gender segregation on college campuses. Yet, when the Arab Spring erupted in Tunisia in 2011, Islamist leaders there called for a gender equality law and adopted a progressive constitution. In Southeast Asia, the Malaysian Islamic Youth Movement, founded by Brotherhood activists in the 1970s, are dropping the group's Islamist identity in favor of interfaith projects with Christians and Buddhists. When Cesar Chavez died in 1993, the United Farm Workers was at a low point, fighting against growers who refused to sign union contracts with farm workers who voted to join the UFW under California's Agricultural Labor Relations Act. At the time, farm workers' wages were falling in California, recalls Arturo Rodriguez, who succeeded Chavez as head of the UFW and succeeded in reforming the union's tactics to regain membership. Now Rodriguez, who is retiring, will be succeeded by Teresa Romero, a native of Mexico City. While union contract workers are now generally much higher than the minimum wage, the UFW and its new leader face a daunting challenge in trying to raise the income of farm workers. For several decades, corporate growers have been globalizing their operations, growing fruit and vegetables in many countries. At the same time, as trade agreements like NAFTA have displaced poor rural communities in Mexico and Central America, farmers have come to the U.S. looking for work and survival. Major growers are now increasing the number of H-2A temporary workers they bring into the U.S. with cheaper, less protected contract laborers. In response, the UFW is striving to sign contracts that represent both long-term resident farm workers and guest workers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The testimony of Christine Blasey Ford and Judge Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's Supreme Court nominee before the Senate Judiciary Committee on September 27th, was a study in contrasts. Where Dr. Ford calmly and confidently recounted the night she says that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her at a high school party in 1982, Kavanaugh was alternately weepy and belligerent, charging that a left-wing conspiracy was out to destroy his life. Apart from multiple accusations of sexual assault, Kavanaugh's conduct at his confirmation hearing has raised serious questions about his honesty and temperament, qualities deemed critical in selecting a Supreme Court justice who's given a lifetime appointment. With GOP Arizona Senator Jeff Flake's demand for an FBI investigation into Dr. Ford's and other sexual assault allegations made against Kavanaugh, the Republican-controlled Senate was forced to delay a final vote on his confirmation. Your reporter spoke with independent journalist Joanne Wipajewski, who talks about her recent article titled, What Brett Kavanaugh Really Learned in High School, Make the Rules, Break the Rules, and Prosper, which examines the privilege and entitlement Brett Kavanaugh took with him from his elite prep school to his partisan political activism and legal career.
Now, we continue to be in this situation where people are saying, well, I believe her, I believe him. And I certainly believe her a whole lot more than I did before those hearings, and I find him even more unqualified to be justice on the Supreme Court than I had before. And really, even if he is completely innocent, I think his behavior at the hearings, a figure unhinged, a figure of tremendous self-importance and self-regard, a bully, a highly, highly partisan individual, a person who is dismissive of women, who was angry. You expect him to be angry. He would be inhuman if he wasn't angry. But the vitriol with which he spewed his conspiracy theories and with which his responses to the questions, the way he didn't answer questions, the way he was evasive, and the way he flat out lied. And now I think that's how he ought to be judged. And I think this Senate hearing was set up to say, do we believe her? Do we believe him? There was no evidence put into the record there. It was not a court. It was not a trial. It was, as they kept saying, a job interview. And I really think after that performance, who would hire such a figure?
You took Brett Kavanaugh's high school experience and really fast-forwarded to his work in the George W. Bush administration, working on issues such as torture that was authorized by the Bush administration in the aftermath of 9/11.
So here's a guy, he's in high school. He's with a lot of kids who are privileged to be in that school. Most of them are upper middle class or better. He is part of a world of, you know, his father's a lobbyist, his mother's a judge. A lot of people jump off from that school into higher realms. But really, they're young, they're drunk, they're breaking the law, right? These kids, by the many stories we've heard in the press, they rented beach houses out in Maryland. They ripped those beach houses up. They destroyed the houses of their friends. Nobody was sent to jail. Brett Kavanaugh was, in his yearbook, he says he was a member of the Rehoboth Beach Police Fan Club. The police would regularly come to these houses, tell them to knock it off, tell them to quiet down. They didn't have to ever pay for anything they did. So you get that sense, if you're a kid and you can break the rules, and then you go to college that tells you that you're special, you're among, that you're going to be part of the ruling class, that you're there because you are the very best, and you know you're the very best, and you know there's no accountability for your actions at all. this is what you hear your whole life. This is what's impressed upon you your whole life. Then you get into the White House, and you're with a lot of people who are saying, it doesn't matter if we break the law. It doesn't matter if we pay attention to international law. It doesn't matter if we arrest people who are Muslims in Afghanistan, and we're going to put them in a prison in Cuba, Guantanamo. We're going to send them to black sites all over the place. We're going to torture them. We're going to ignore our international commitments. We're going to ignore everything. We can do it because we're the bully on the block. And I think these kids were bullies on the block when they were youths. And I think they got used to lying, and I think they got used to having their way. And what's so clear about Brett Kavanaugh is he dissembled or outright lied to Congress about his participation in at least one discussion of the torture program, the detention program without, you know, the end of habeas corpus that was going on in the Bush administration. He dissembled or outright lied about other things, you know, whether he got documents that belonged to the Democrats. He was not truthful in all his testimony during those hearings. So he has a record, you know, between what he said and what Blasey Ford said. She was much more credible than he was. But he has a record of dissembling and evasion. And he has a record of being someone who thinks the rules don't apply to him and don't apply to his class and his group. The fact that he signed on to a case that was whether Titan and Kachi, which are private contractors that supplied interrogators and translators to the U.S. government to work in black sites and in Abu Ghraib prison. And he signed on to the decision there saying that the people who were victimized, who were tortured by these contractors in Iraq, couldn't sue for civil liability, couldn't sue Titan and Kachi. And the decision he signed on to was so obscure and so remote, and basically just saying that we have to protect Titan and Kachi, we have to protect these corporations. And you completely forget what the subject is once you as you're reading this tortured prose, sorry for the word, but until you get to Merrick Garland, of all people, his dissent in the same case. And there in the center, at the very front of his dissent, is the human person, you know, beaten, blinded, humiliated, strung up, shocked, raped, forced to watch his father die, extinguished. That's what you get from Merrick Garland. From Brett Kavanaugh, you get the sense that how do we set the rules to get the rich guys off? But it did get back to your question about high school, in that one of the things that was so striking about his performance at the Senate was his absolute sense that he'd been denied something he deserves by right. This incredible entitlement. And, you know, we hear this word a lot, but that's what really came through for me watching the hearings, was how enraged he was, mostly for himself, how his humanity didn't seem to extend much beyond himself, and how his interests fundamentally were about his having gone to the right school, him having worked his tail off, worked, how he deserves this moment. And, you know, nobody deserves to be on the Supreme Court, and certainly no one who probably was a blackout drunk in high school.
That was independent journalist Joanne Wipajewski, co-editor of the book Killing Trayvons, an anthology of American violence. Find a link to her article titled What Brett Kavanaugh Really Learned in High School: Make the Rules, Break the Rules, and Prosper, and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In September 2017, when U.S. President Donald Trump first addressed the annual meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, he threatened to totally destroy North Korea and attacked a number of U.S. adversaries across the globe. Trump's caustic remarks were no surprise to world leaders, who'd observed this president's strange and disturbing behavior since he was sworn into office in January 2017. In his second address before the UN General Assembly this year, on September 25th, Trump spoke about his rejection of globalism, a reference to the UN's multilateral approach of bringing nations together to address global crises. Instead, Trump promoted his own vague brand of patriotism, known to his political base by the slogan America First. At the UN, Trump was characteristically antagonistic to friend and foe alike, with threats to impose new tariffs and sanctions as part of his current trade war. The president's accusations against China for what he claimed were plans to subvert the upcoming U.S. midterm congressional election were met with anger and derision. When Trump addressed the UN Security Council about his decision to withdraw the U.S. from the Iran nuclear agreement, virtually all nations present rejected Trump's position and spoke of their support for the Iran deal. During his major address to the UN, when Trump claimed to have accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of the U.S., the hundreds of diplomats and government officials gathered broke into open laughter. Your reporter spoke with Dee Parvez, global politics reporter with Think Progress, who assesses world reaction to President Trump's presence at this year's UN General Assembly.
Last year, President Trump took to the UN floor and threatened to, quote, totally destroy a country of 22 million or so, annihilate them. And then this year, he actually said before the UN Security Council meeting, which we'll get to in a second, that he'd gotten to know Chairman Kim and had gotten to like him quite a bit. This year at his general debate speech, you know, all the leaders get up and it's hours of all the leaders speechifying. He spoke for about 30 minutes. He was a little late in arriving, so they had to go out of order in order to accommodate that. And he basically gave a rather spectacular speech in some sense, in that it was a complete rebuke of globalism and multilateralism, which is, you know, the whole point of the UN, for everybody to work together. And he made it quite clear that the U.S. under his administration had no interest in that. And it got into the weeds a little bit. He started talking about how the U.S. would only help countries that did something for them, which is completely, you know, flies in the face of what something like humanitarian aid is, which is what they've cut to millions of Palestinians, for example. You know, it was quite a jarring speech, and everybody took note. And subsequent leaders who spoke, such as French President Emmanuel Macron, made a, you know, very pointed stance countering President Trump's speech, saying that, you know, the only way to move forward was to work with each other, and that we should resist such sentiment. Even President Hassan Rouhani of Iran said the same thing. A person who rejects multilateralism is not a strong person, but that doing so was, I think he's put it as a symptom of a weak intellect. Now, he never named President Trump, but everybody in the room knew exactly who he was talking about.
Dee Parvez, I did want to ask you about Donald Trump's refusal, along with the nation of Hungary, led by a right-wing government, to sign a global compact on migrants and refugees. As you wrote in your article, you talk about 68.5 million people have been displaced across the globe due to conflicts and natural disasters and famine and all that. Tell us a little bit about this particular compact that Trump, along with Hungary, refused to sign.
Very interesting company. So basically, the Obama administration in 2016, his last UN summit in New York, launched the refugee summit. So basically, he got all the world leaders to get together, whoever would sign up to it, that is, to pledge, to make additional pledges to either monetarily or, you know, in terms of hosting more refugees. And the other part of that was that the member states vowed to get together and come up with a more comprehensive plan to handle migrants and refugees. So the Trump administration is largely focused on dismantling anything that President Obama put together. That seems to be a primary focus. And so, of course, they weren't going to sign on to this. Now, this is extremely disappointing to the rest of the world, to other member states, to global community. UNHCR had a high-level panel on this. There was a United States representative present there. This person did not speak at all, because what could they say? But yeah, it's remarkable that the U.S. has kept company with a very staunchly and harshly anti-refugee and anti-migrant government, and a very far right-wing government that, you know, even among right-wing governments in Europe is an outlier, which is Hungary and Viktor Orban.
To sum it up, Dee Parvez, what would you say the lasting result of this UN encounter between Trump and the nations of the world in New York last week?
Well, I think that, you know, it serves to make other nations more cautious, and not in a good way. He's not seen as a reliable, approachable leader, I don't think. So I think it damages any kind of like trust or diplomatic sort of protocol built over decades between the U.S. as a leader in a number of these U.N. institutions and councils and the rest of the world and, you know, other member states, our allies included.
That was Dee Parvez, global politics reporter with thinkprogress.org. Find a link to her article titled, "The U.N. General Assembly is Not Going So Well for President Trump," and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Urban planners and transportation advocates say that the single most important element that increases bicycling in cities and towns is a bike share program. That's where fleets of bikes are stationed around town in groups of 10 to 25, and people can rent them by the hour. Most major U.S. cities, like New York, Washington, D.C., Houston, Phoenix, Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, have bike share programs, along with many mid-sized cities. Between 2010 and 2016, bike share riders took more than 88 million trips, with New Yorkers being by far the most active bikers. In 2016, 56 cities and towns were listed as having bike share programs. That number doesn't include additional programs launched since then. New Haven, Connecticut, with a population of 130,000, for example, launched their bike program in February 2018. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Carolyn Lush, program manager with Bike New Haven. Here she explains how the city's public-private partnership differs from other big city bike share programs.
This is a public-private partnership with the City of New Haven. It is funded through a mix of user revenue and advertising. So it does not use any public money, any city money. And it is also unique compared with some cities in that it was really created with residents of New Haven in mind rather than tourists. Some bike share programs are really geared towards tourists. But
can you share with us some of the data? How many bikes are out there and their use and the different areas of the city and all that?
At the moment, we still just have 100 bikes, but we are very close to getting another 80 bikes out there. They're having the final touches put on right now in our warehouse. Our stations are throughout mostly the more inner part of the city, but getting into some of the outer neighborhoods as well at this point. The first phase is going to be 300 bikes. So we hope by the end of this year to have 300 bikes out.
Okay. And then is there a plan for a second phase and more bikes?
Potentially going to have 400 because we'll have 40 stations. So 10 per station would be kind of the maximum. Aside from that, it really depends on what we see in terms of ridership. It depends on the feedback that we get, and we'll go from there.
Okay, so speaking of ridership, what can you tell us about that just around the stations that you already have?
We have seen so far almost 7,000 rental sessions and 11,000 trips. So those two numbers are different because a rental session may contain more than one trip. Someone stops the bike to get coffee or do something else. So that is where we're at right now. We have over 7,000 miles cycled total, about 1,000 hours of cycling. We're happy with the learning curve that we've seen in terms of people starting to use the system more and more, and expect that to really continue once we get more of these bikes out there.
Explain exactly what someone does. Someone wants to rent a bike. They see these pretty green bikes out in various places. What do they do?
At the moment, someone would need to have a smartphone to use the system, and that's something that hopefully in the future we're going to work out other options. So on their phone, they would go to their app store and look for the Bike New Haven app. It's free. Download it and create an account with an email address and then link a credit card. And that is another thing we're working on, is getting cash-based passes, hopefully for the future. So once the credit card is linked and the account is made, then all you have to do is pull up the button that says scan to unlock and use your phone to scan the QR code on the back of whatever bike you are trying to unlock. That releases the lock on the rear wheel, and then the clock has started for the rental session.
And how long is the rental session?
A rental session is 45 minutes, and so all of the passes, whether it's a day pass, month, or year pass, that's an increment of 45 minutes, unlimited 45-minute trips. Above that, if you go beyond 45 minutes, you're charged an extra amount, in most cases $2, for every additional 45-minute increment.
What does it actually cost, and are there tiers, or does everybody pay the same price?
We have our standard prices, which is $1.75 for just one 45-minute trip, and then $20 for a month pass and $90 for a year pass. However, we also have discounts. We have a senior and student rate, which is $50 for a year pass. And we also have a $15 year pass that's available for people who are on state benefits.
Wow. That's pretty reasonable. So among all your data there, do you have a breakout of people who are in those different categories or what they pay? Or is it people who work downtown, or is it kids who live out in the different neighborhoods? Or do you have any of that data?
We've seen a really great variety of that. And we did do a survey of our mailing list recently to see how people are using the system. And it was just a wide variety of things that people put down, that they use it to get to work, to get to the grocery store, to go to coffee shops and restaurants, to go to doctor's appointments. So we've seen it used in a variety of ways, and we are hoping to, spread the word about those reduced cost passes and about how to use it so that we can get more and more people using it.
That was Carolyn Lush, program manager with Bike New Haven. Learn more about bike share programs in the U.S. and around the world by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.